playing golf this summer using a golf cart? Are you using your air conditioning in this record-breaking heat? Do you buy food that's shipped in from another location? If so, listen up to find out how those golf carts and AC systems are built and sustainably, and how those foods arrive fresh at your market in specially outfitted trucks. This is sustainable product management, and it's one of the biggest challenges today. So we're going to find out from a woman who leads these efforts at one of the top companies in the world how this is done. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility, energy, and sustainability-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain insight from more women like me and our accomplished guests, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. I'd like you to meet Rasha Hassanin. Rasha is Vice President of Product Management Excellence and Innovation at Ingersoll Rand. What a fabulous title. Ingersoll Rand, for those of you who are not familiar with the company, is a global manufacturer of a range of products you see or benefit from every day. They manufacture those golf carts I mentioned in the introduction that you see on the PGA Tour coverage or use in the golf courses. They manufacture the Trane air conditioning systems you may have in your home or office or see advertised on television. And they also make professional level power tools that you may see on a construction site, as well as those refrigerated trucks that transport perishable food to your local market safely. Rasha's background information says she, quote, focuses on inspiring sustainable innovation through technology, in that she's responsible for, quote, incubating and accelerating innovation across the company, close quote. Both of which, of course, interest us on Green Connections, so we are eager to find out how she does it, and in such a huge global company. And as an aside, her background also says she has a PhD in philosophy, engineering, business, and policy, and you know I want to know about that combination. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Rasha, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joan. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, good, 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 good. So, first of all, let's get our terminology straight so we're all on the same page. How do you define product management?
For us, and I think the definition is varies from company to company quite a bit and from industry to industry, but for us, well, it starts with really understanding the need for the customer expresses, right? And so depending on our business unit, for example, in our climate businesses or in the Trane business unit for commercial buildings, we want to understand what facility managers really need in order to ensure the personal comfort of the people in their buildings. And so they spend time really understanding what's needed, what their needs are, and how they make their buying decisions. They then take that back and they say, okay, given, you know, everything we know and all of the technology out there, what are the types of products and the product characteristics that are then needed to do that? And then they develop really a product strategy. They say, hey, in order for us to really serve those needs and win in the marketplace, here are the things our products need to do. Here's how we need to go to market. And they take that to our engineering colleagues, our manufacturing colleagues who then design those products and then who manufacture those products. And then the product manager works with sales to then and marketing to really then take those products to market, build awareness, and then ensure that our customers are getting what they told us they wanted, right? And so that process day to day involves spending a ton of time with customers, a ton of time with engineering, helping them understand that product market fit, and then a ton of time really operationally making sure that we can get product to our customers. And that happens throughout the product's life cycle. So when we first get it to our customer and then we service it all the way through its life cycle. And then at the very end of life, we look at how we dispose of the product. So our product managers really understand what those customers are doing with their products, where they are in the life cycle, how they're servicing them, how we make sure that those products remain up and running. and then how we end of life them.
So I know that you focus on the sustainability angle. So where does sustainability come in that process that you just so eloquently described? That was a very good description of the stages, if you will. So where does sustainability come into it? And do your customers ask for sustainability-oriented features and benefits? Is that something that they, you talk about knowing your market's needs and listening to the market's needs. Are they asking for it, or is Ingersoll Rand just choosing to find a way to manufacture them in a way that's sustainable?
That's a really good question. And it's pretty, it's multifaceted. So let me start by kind of telling you how we kind of look at the world of sustainability. We look at sustainability sort of along four pillars. The first pillar is around customer outcomes. So how do we enable our customers to be more sustainable? And the reason we do that is because the HVAC or climate world is a huge consumer of energy. And so when we look at sustainability, we're looking at how to cool without causing more global warming, right? And so it's this dichotomy and balance between ensuring, and it's not just about comfort, right? In certain areas, it's a life-sustaining cooling with having as little impact on the environment as possible. So that's sort of our customer outcome, like the sustainability of our product. We look at sustainability of our operations, and that's where we talk about how do we manufacture our products as sustainably as possible. We look at our people, we look at diversity, and we look at parity, and we look at are we reflecting the populations in which we serve, and are we getting the most creative and the most diverse set of opinions around decision-making that will make sure that we have the best innovation in the market. And so the sustainability of our people and our workforce becomes really important. And then finally, we look at citizenship. And there we look at the concept of life-sustaining cooling at what we call the bottom of the pyramid. So in areas that are emerging, where populations are emerging, that tend to be more severely impacted by disasters, more severely impacted by heat waves, et cetera. And we look at how can we apply what we're doing to life-sustaining cooling for these people who need it, as well as in terms of cooling in the delivery of food and critical medicines and vaccines to those people as well. Those are really underserved segments as it relates to cooling. So we've got those four pillars, and the product management and innovation functions really serve across many of those pillars. But our primary focus is really tied to customer outcomes. And when you ask, hey, are your customers pulling for sustainable solutions? The answer is, it depends. Some customers, they're very strong mission focused, and they will look for sustainable companies to do business with. And some are a little bit more pragmatic. Most are smaller or emerging companies in that area. And so when we look at sustainable customer outcomes, what we're talking about is making sure that sustainable solutions are also economically the right solutions for our customers. So it's a win-win on both ends. And so we look at elements like energy efficiency, right? The more efficient something is, the less it costs our customers to operate it, but at the same time, the more sustainable it is because it's using less critical energy. And so that's really what we look at. And so while we love the fact that many of our customers are focusing on sustainability and love doing business with mission or purpose-based organizations, we don't need that in order for us to really drive sustainable outcomes moving forward. We take it on ourselves to say, how do we create a sustainable product that also has economic benefit for our customers? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Do you find that in order to, just one quick clarifying question of this, do you find that in order to recruit a diverse workforce that the people who you are interviewing are asking about the company's sustainability efforts? Is that something that they overtly value?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're finding that a lot. And as we're starting to see sort of generational changes in the workforce, that's becoming more and more critical. A lot of industrial companies really struggle with attracting, for example, digital talent because, you know, you're in Silicon Valley and you want to go work for Google or you want to work for Amazon. The HVAC company is not necessarily, you know, the place you think about. And so what helps us really attract the talent that has these capabilities of the future is really that sustainability story, the ability to tangibly be able to impact the global greenhouse gas footprint of the world is a great story for us. And it tends to resonate incredibly well, especially with younger talent, with talent that has grown up with sustainability that's in sort of top of mind for them. And so we're finding that story resonating incredibly well, not just with recruiting talent, but also with partnering. Like on the innovation side, we partner with startups, we partner with strategic partners that have some of this tip of the spear technology in areas where we truly are not going to become experts, but we need to leverage that technology. That sustainability focus helps us with immediate common ground. And then we can start to have conversations from there. And so it, in my opinion, gets us really having conversations with companies we may not have had conversations with if we didn't have that common purpose.
Oh, that's interesting. So that becomes a common value with the organizations that you want to partner with to help get them over the hurdle of agreeing to partner with you.
Exactly.
Oh, that's very interesting. That is, and that's the companies of any startups run by any kind of person of any kind of age or ethnicity?
Absolutely. And not just startups. You know, we're not a GE, we're not a Siemens. We don't have that scale, right? But we sort of punch above our weight whenever we have conversations with large strategic partners, even because of our purpose and our focus on sustainability, because many of the larger cutting edge companies that we would see in the market today tend to have sustainability as a focus and a purpose. So startups of any diversity, of any sort of gender or ethnicity in terms of composition, but also large strategic partners that we would want to work with.
That's really interesting. And we can talk about that a little bit. But take me through, I mean, the products that, and by the way, Ingersoll Rand is not exactly a small company either. So
it's not. It's not a $300 million company either. So
right. No, I get it. But you know, you're not a 10-person startup here. Okay.
Exactly.
So the products that you make that I described and that you're describing, the HVAC systems, the power tools, the golf carts, these trucks, the refrigerated trucks, etc. These all have to have huge timelines to be developed, and they're capital intensive, and the R&D takes a lot of risk and guts and advanced planning and advanced resource allocation. So how do you keep up with, I mean, the market need that's there now may not be something that you may take time to develop something to meet it, right? So how does your innovation team respond to or anticipate, maybe is a better word, the market needs in time to allocate the resources and build them to match the market need and not be behind it?
That's a great question. I would answer that question in two chunks. The first is a lot of times the market needs can be fulfilled by what I would call like a system augmentation. So you can develop innovations that augment an existing system more quickly than you can to design sort of a full-blown system. And in a lot of cases, if you understand the need incredibly well, you can fulfill that need in multiple ways, some of which can be additions to a system, and that'll allow us to go to market pretty quickly. So there's kind of that piece of it. The other big thing, and that's a lot more kind of on the product management side, is this is why sort of bringing together product management excellence and innovation is great. On the product management side, you know, one of the key roles of our product managers is to understand our customers better than anybody else. And when you have product managers who really understand your customers, what they identify are latent needs or early needs that have not fully come to fruition, even in the customer's head. But because you understand the application and you understand them and those markets kind of better than anybody else, you can anticipate where you think the market is going. And then you can start early enough to develop product. And so partnering with the innovation team, partnering with the product management community allows us to really get ahead of where customers even know they're going, right? It's really identifying those latent needs early to give us enough time to develop those applications. And then finally, we are constantly looking at ways to shorten our time to market constantly. So we're always looking at ways to make that ability to go from idea all the way to sort of market ready solution as short and as nimble as possible. And so we'll constantly be doing that. Now, it's not, there are just some things that take time. You still have to design and test and build. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as much as we can sort of squeeze out the waste. And so we're a lean company. We practice Lean Six Sigma on the industrial side, and we try and leverage that as much as possible to compress that time. So I think the combination of those three things really allow us to bring innovation to market in a different way and then for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. No, that's cool. How do you reconcile durability with sustainability? There are a lot of people who believe that there's a trade-off, that you have to, you know, that's one of their concerns of, they'll say, well, I can't make it sustainable because it has to last forever, or it has to have a 20-year lifespan, or it has to, you know, fill in the blank. How does Ingersoll Rand reconcile durability with sustainability and then sell that argument, if you will, to your customers?
We actually don't subscribe to that frame of thought, to be fair. We genuinely believe that when you look at innovation and you have sustainability, a tenet of that, it becomes one of your kind of your design tenets, then there should be ways for you to not have to trade that off. And we found that pretty regularly. And so the only place that doesn't play is sometimes the cost doesn't work. So sometimes you have to trade price. But for example, I'll give you an example. You know, as we look at refrigerants are sort of a big consideration for us because of the global warming potential. We are constantly trying to find refrigerants that are next generation and the next generation that reduce that global warming potential. When we do that, what we try and do is we hold that system efficiency constant. We say, okay, what can we find that allows us to do this while maintaining what our customers expect in terms of performance? And 9 times out of 10, that solution is found. And then we're constantly iterating on that solution. And so if you hold the customer value and the sustainability of the product as core to your design, you're going to find, and you get really smart people with diverse thinking in a room, you're going to find solutions that allow you to address both. I think the trade-off, and it might be different in different industries, but for us, we don't put that as an option, right? We basically say, hey, you know, we've got to have both. And so what does it take to do both? And if there is a difference in cost or price, then what is the additional value to the customer that we can realize? And in a lot of cases, we can get better efficiency and better sustainability in some of these innovations. And so there is value to justify that additional cost.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's an ancillary benefit too, like, you know, it does X, Y, and Z better, or the byproduct, it's a byproduct of something else that ends up. I mean, one of the things, I think, you know, I interviewed Maria Blase a while back. She's fabulous. And one of the things that she and I talked about was finding ways to use the byproducts of some of the processes that you guys have, because there are lots of them, right? And then rather than just kind of to reduce the waste, but then also make it a win-win so that it actually becomes something usable.
Absolutely. And we've been talking really about circularity. When we talk about, as part of our 2030 sustainability commitment, we talked about designing systems for circularity. And we've just recently been having a lot of these conversations. And a lot of times, the things that are the hardest, for example, to recycle are also the hardest to produce. And if there's a way for us to reuse some of that, it actually will offset a lot of our upfront costs. And so to the extent that we can find these win-win situations, I think that there's no lose with things like that. Just a little bit more upfront work that you have to go do to think about it. And it's also a mindset shift. And it's not that people don't want to do it. It's just, with everything going on, this has to be front and center for them. So as we start to look for those opportunities, I think you're going to see a lot more of this. Hey, what can we do to reuse, recycle elements of our product? What can we do to reuse byproducts of our operations and so on? And to the extent that it's front of mind, you're going to see a lot more of that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, and it involves people learning about things they haven't had to learn about before, right? So understanding what is easy to recycle and what isn't easy to recycle is important. And if you understand that, hey, you know, embedding glass and metal makes it really hard to recycle the glass and the metal, you might come back and design something that doesn't have that interface in it from the front end. And lo and behold, you may find a design benefit to doing that even in the performance of the machine itself. But if you start with that in mind, you'll create something different. The issue is most people who have not grown up with this front center wouldn't even know that, right? You need to go seek experts in those areas to say, hey, here are the things that make things hard to recycle, or here are the things that make this hard to reuse. And then how do we, all the way up in the front of the design process, start to build things that make it easier and easier for there to be circular design?
Oh, that's cool. So you're an innovator. I'm an innovator. So take me into the room. How does creating a new product start? Where does the spark come from?
It actually can come from a lot of different places.
How does it germinate? I mean, you guys need to be producing new stuff and innovating all the time. Do your teams have, you know, the proverbial 15 or 20% time where they can work on something, whatever they want? Does somebody come in and say, hey, I just had an idea. Can we, you know, have 10 people get together in this room with a whiteboard and, you know, flesh it out? Or how does that work?
I think there's in terms of organic innovation, I think a lot of that happens as part of some of the constructs that we have in place. Our company is organized into what we call product growth teams that are cross-functional teams, and they're focused on a product or portfolio in a market. And in that team, you know, there's a lot of interaction between the product manager, who's really focused on the customer needs in the market, and bringing all of that sort of thought process around what those customers need and where can we really innovate to help them. The engineering organization, which is really focused on what are the new and exciting technologies out there that might be used to solve some critical customer issues. And then typically with a supply chain person who's really looking at what's new in the sort of in the manufacturing area, what's really cutting edge there that might be able to help us solve a problem for a customer. But fundamentally, right, that organic type innovation happens. And we have tools in our operating system to help them with that. So we have innovation tools they can use, methodologies to spur and capture ideas around ideation. There's a lot there. And so there is that organic piece, and specifically around those product growth teams. Now, those product growth teams spend a lot of time with both the field, so people like our service technicians, our sales teams, who are constantly seeing this, and they're capturing those ideas and they're capturing competitive information. And there is time and space as they're thinking about their refreshing their product strategy every year to really think about where are we really going to innovate, focused on real unmet or latent needs with a customer. In addition to that, we do have constructs within the organization that whose job it is every day to think about what are the big problems we need to solve for our customers and where can we innovate. So we have a number of networks of excellence, which are our advanced technology groups that are constantly out there in key areas trying to identify new and exciting technology that could be applied to problems. My team, for example, around incubation is constantly looking at new ways to innovate from a business model perspective, from an overall product perspective. And we'll partner very closely on those sorts of things. But the goal is to really understand those big problems to solve. And in the industrial world, right, and in a lot of worlds, those problems don't change every day, but how you might solve them could. And so we have a portfolio approach where, you know, we've got people who are really focused on the problem and then innovating around some of these solutions. So understanding how we do it today, but what are some of the ways we could do it differently? Or what are some key problems that we haven't been able to solve in the past that we can, because of some new technology or some new innovation out there, can go solve? And so, you know, there isn't a playbook for this, right? It's a combination of sort of organic innovation happening at the product growth team level. But as those teams start to surface things that maybe don't fit straight down the line of what their product or portfolio does, they know to come to us. So we will operate on a pull model. They'll come to me personally through their leadership and they'll say, hey, we have this problem. Can we spin up an innovation project on this for you guys to help us think through that? And we'll do that as well. And so it can come from a number of different places, to be fair. And it ranges anywhere from, like, I'm in a product growth team and I'm doing some incremental innovation or some adjacent innovation with my current market, all the way to sort of moonshot, let's go figure out how we play in the smart cities world, right? Within the organization. And that is a tenuous and delicate balance every day that we walk.
Oh, I'm sure. So what's your biggest challenge?
Look, I think my biggest challenge is really, you know, for me, I always feel like in order for you to really make an impact and innovate, you have to have a healthy balance between understanding the dynamics of what is today, but understanding and having a vision for what could be. And I typically don't have an issue with what could be. My biggest challenge is really getting a good handle on today so that I can speak in the language of the majority, right? And so one of the things that's important for my team is for us to have that buy-in and that support to go do these things that are really kind of out there. And they rely on me to be able to speak in the language of an industrial company, you know, a relatively established industrial company, but to convey those messages of innovation and the potential in a meaningful way. And I think that continues to be my biggest challenge, right? You come up, you find these really fantastic nuggets of innovation out there, either with a startup or with something that somebody even in the organization did kind of in their spare time. And you're trying to get people to think about what it could be. And they're looking at you like, yeah, no. And you're like, okay, so I have data. What do you have? My gut tells me. I'm like, okay, my data is bigger than your gut, but let's talk about my data, right? But so that continues to be my biggest, you know, my biggest challenge is really, you know, you have to have your data down when you don't have that domain expertise. But even when you have all of the data in the world, there is still this sense of understanding that people need to feel like you have for their industry before they're willing to give you the benefit of the doubt, right? And that will be my challenge probably until the day I retire, because, you know, as an innovator, that's what I do. And so people look at me like I have 10 heads and that's okay. But at some point I need them to like do something so we can do this, and bridging that gap between you have 10 heads and yeah, that's a good idea, let's go do that is probably the biggest challenge I'll face from now until then.
Well, I agree. I mean, I was the same way. My president of the company used to joke, I'd just stand in the doorway of his office and he'd go, uh-oh, there she is. I know you're here to take me out of my comfort zone. Give me a minute. And he'd grab the arms of his chair and he'd go, okay, I'm ready. Try me. And I'd present something and he'd look at me and go, how the hell do you come up with this stuff? And then I go, Rick, it's not going to cost us this, or it's only going to cost us this, or it's just my time, or it's just blah, 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 blah. And, you know, like I created a partnership with AERP from Whole Cloth. I mean, I literally looked at not just top line market data, but throughout the methodology market data, and it was screaming AERP to me. And yeah, I was living, they had moved me to the Midwest. And so I said, you know, I want to talk to AERP. And he was like, you're nuts. But, you know, if you want to do it, you know, talk to them. But I'm not spending money for you to go back to DC to talk to them. So I had to come back anyway to do a speech that I was booked for. And so I cold called somebody. I can't even remember how I found them. And I had a great conversation, set up a meeting. I walked in. I expected it to be like him and I over coffee. There were six people there. A 20-minute meeting turned into a 2-hour meeting. By the time I left, we had a multi-part collaboration that ultimately was so successful that Chrysler adopted it for the whole company. And it was like, they were looking at me like, really? Like how?
Yeah, right.
You know, like, explain this to me.
Oh, I hear you. I hear you. But it's that potential, right? It's that potential for growth that keeps us really going after some of these innovations. I mean, if the potential wasn't there, we wouldn't want to do them.
Well, that's right. And it's also being prepared when you bring it up to anybody to address whatever the obstacles are they're going to raise, including being able to say, I don't know, but I'm working to find out.
Exactly. And also, I think being able to provide, knowing that you don't have all the details, but being able and confident enough to provide enough detail around, like you said, all the way through the methodology, for example, right? A lot of times when you're innovating, you don't have everything down to the P&L OI level, right? But you do have enough information that you can present that shows that there's a compelling value proposition and a compelling business case. And a lot of times that's all leaders want. But a lot of times you also see the extremes, which is I have a great idea, but I have nothing to back it up, or I have a ticked and tied business case and the idea is pretty incremental, right? And so the sort of in the middle, the ability to articulate that value and that business case in the middle where you've got, you know, just enough information. I keep telling my team all the time, accurate, but not precise, right? That the business case holds, but it doesn't have to be to the third decimal and it doesn't have to be all the way down to EBITDA, but let's show that there's a value proposition and that we can make money in this market, then let's go out and try and pilot. And that is not easy for a lot of leaders in traditional organizations to get their head around.
Yeah, but that's exactly where the competitive advantage is, frankly. So you've talked a lot about, I want to ask you one thing and then I'll ask you a couple questions about you before I let you go. But you talked a lot about diverse teams. So how do you recruit those diverse teams? Because, you know, like for example, as I said, I was an anomaly at Chrysler, and they, you know, their idea of diversity was from another part of North Dakota before I rolled into town. And, you know, and I'm a born and bred New York City girl. So, I mean, I was a Martian from outer space. And again, I didn't come through their traditional system, which is a good thing, because if I had, they wouldn't know who I was. And this is a big problem right now, is that innovators like you and me, I mean, you have a very traditional corporate background. I worked at Deloitte. I worked at American Express. I get that. You've been, it seems, pretty continuous from GE and SAP, et cetera. But how do you find people who are creative thinkers, especially of diverse women and diverse populations, who might frankly be screened out of your traditional applicant tracking system?
Right. So, and that's a good question. So I can speak for myself and then I can speak a little broader for IR. So I'm obviously a diverse person myself. So woman of color in a very non-traditional sort of background and career. And so there's a little bit of diverse talent being attracted to diverse talent. So for me personally, I rarely have issues recruiting diversity, you know, because of that, to be fair, competitive advantage, right? And I am really passionate and, you know, and I interview well. I don't interview candidates. Candidates interview me, but I interview well from that perspective. I love what I do and I tend to be pretty empowering to my team and that will kind of show through. So I get a lot of referrals, but then I also will tend to get a diverse talent that's attracted to me. So what I do is when that happens, I don't let it go. So I, you know, if I meet diverse talent and then I start to have conversations with them and I realize, you know, they're really great. I may not have an opportunity right now, but I will mentor and I will coach and I will stay connected. And so this sort of network of diverse and highly sort of creative rock stars, ninjas, whatever you want to call them, I like to maintain that both inside the company and outside the company so that when an opportunity arises, I need to bring them in or I can refer them to the right opportunity. And so I'll do that. With respect to Ingersoll Rand, I will say that one, referrals are a big deal and I get a lot of, hey, we've got an opening. If you know anyone, let me know. So that's a big deal here. Ingersoll Rand is very relationship focused, which I love. And so that building of relationships and that focus on, hey, if you believe in this person, then they're, you know, when we believe in you, then we kind of believe in that person is definitely real. But more sort of systematically, what we're doing is, and we've been doing this with our HR business partners as functional leaders, is we're going through our functional jobs. So for product management, our functional job descriptions, and we're saying, what in here is limiting diverse talent from applying? And maybe I don't need 20 years of HVAC experience because there weren't women in HVAC 20 years ago. So maybe I can relax that requirement, right? For example. And so, you know, we're taking a really critical eye to how we write job descriptions, how we screen talent into the talent pool, into the applicant pool. How are we populating the slate? You know, when you have a parity commitment, you know, that's serious, right? And so working with our HR business partners, especially in these technical roles, how are we making sure that these job descriptions aren't naturally excluding women from applying? And so that's you know, one of the things we do. We also participate in a number of sort of national chapters. So the Society of Women Engineers, NSBE, there's a ton of these that we support. And it is really the people in the organization that are doing that. So my counterpart in engineering excellence is a very active member of the Society of Women Engineers. We go to the conference kind of every year with the intent to recruit. We do a lot of events that way. And so you sort of, that's kind of your traditional, like go to the event and do the thing. But what we're trying to do is really look in the mirror and say, what are we doing that's imposing unconscious bias in our job descriptions and our screening processes and our interviewing processes, et cetera, and making sure that we are capturing the best talent. I'll just tell you a short story. When I was in school, I did diversity in management. When I was doing my master's, I did diversity in management, and they had a number of speakers, and there was an African-American woman who was working for O at the time, which is now OWN, you know, for Oprah Winfrey, and she came and spoke. But one of the things she said was, we need diversity in entrepreneurship. We also need diverse talent in large companies to start to change them from the inside. Mm-hmm. And that really stuck with me because that need is there. I mean, it is great to have female entrepreneurs who are going out and starting their own companies, some of which is motivated by frustration in corporate America. But we also need a cohort of women who are fighting the good fight in corporate America to make change from the inside out. Because, you know, at the end of the day, that continues to be in the short term where a lot of the market power sits, right? And so that really stuck with me.
So before I let you go, two very quick things. One is, talk to me about your PhD. Okay, philosophy, you've hit every angle in this one PhD. This has got to be a design your own PhD. Philosophy, engineering.
It was, well, it's a doctor of philosophy. Engineering, business, and public policy was the focus. I mean, it was focused on sustainability, to be fair. And so it was a design your own PhD. I actually ended up graduating a year later because they didn't know how to graduate me. So we had to figure that out. But I was really focused on really understanding holistically sustainability and looking at ways to apply practical policy. And so there just isn't a program that does that. And so I got the engineering piece because I really wanted to understand engineering processes because, you know, as many people know, sustainability is a systems of systems issue, right? You can, you don't want to optimize one thing at the expense of the broader system. You need to make sure that you're being sustainable across the system of systems. So having that broader systems understanding and how to think about it.
So let me just ask you this in closing. What's your advice for women like that? If you're, you know, if they don't work for Ingersoll Rand, but let's say, I mean, you had some of a classic career. I mean, you might be in a non-traditional field, but you worked in, you know, big companies. You went from one to the other very smoothly, right? You didn't have any weird blips along the way, at least not that I could see. So what would you suggest to a woman who is innovative, who's in mid-career, whatever that means to them, right? Because women's careers tend to advance at a different pace than men's in general and later. So, but she wants to use her education and her experience and her passion for making a difference in her career and get ahead and make money. It's not like, oh, we'll go work for a nice, cute nonprofit and sacrifice. I mean, you know, these are ambitious women who are also innovative thinkers. I mean, what do you say to them?
There's a couple of things. One is, come work for Ingersoll Rand. No, sorry. The first thing I would say is become a master at the translation layer.
What does that mean?
And that means don't change who you are. Just learn to articulate what you want to say really well and translate that innovation, that passion into a language that the average person can consume, right? Or the status quo can consume, because being able to speak in that language will get you a large portion of the way there. Let's not underestimate that, right? Let's not underestimate. Don't change who you are. Don't change your passion. Don't change any of that. Become a master at translating that passion and that innovation into a language that people can understand and get behind and rally behind, right? And so that is not an inherent charisma. That's a learned skill. Right. Being able to clearly get all of that complexity and innovation and creativity down into a presentation that people can follow and understand becomes really important. So being able to communicate your ideas in that creativity and that passion in a way that's consumable by others becomes probably the superpower you want to build. And the other thing is just, you know, be resilient and be persistent. And, you know, in a lot of cases, don't take no for an answer, right? Because if you go in assuming the first answer is going to be no, because people don't understand or because they're looking at it from a lens that is a lot more traditional, then you'll be a lot less disappointed when it happens, right? And so having that level of persistence and perseverance and then really tweaking that communication so other people can hear you. It's a tweak, right? It's an interesting tweak. It just takes work and it takes refinement on how to really communicate in that language. And then when you go to a new company, you have to learn it again. But at the end of the day, it's probably the one thing that's helped me more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. That's really brilliant advice. And I love I'm a language person, right? So I love the learn the language part. I was just thinking that as you were talking is you have to do that in the vocabulary that resonates with that organization. And sometimes it's, you know, I joke like when I was at Deloitte, I would say, well, I speak Deloitte, you know, or, you know, I speak Chrysler or I speak Carr or, you know, whatever. And it's like, up to a point, of course, you know, you don't want me working on your engine, believe me. But trust me on that one, or your batteries for that matter. But you have to, it's understanding the values of the organization and it's understanding even the values of the location. I mean, like just because you're ready to pitch an idea doesn't mean that they're ready to receive it.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right with that. So that's it. I mean, that's the one piece of advice I would give anyone in my shoes is, and I've given it to myself many times, like, you're not translating, Rasha, you're not translating.
Well, I'm glad you found environments where they cut you the slack to let you go through the process of translating. That's very cool.
Agreed. Me too.
That's cool. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio, Rasha Hassanin. You've been really terrific and you're a great role model. So I really, really appreciate your time and your wisdom.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed the conversation as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, good. You're welcome. You're welcome. So what concerns you about these air conditioning systems or refrigerated trucks? Or what mentoring lessons did she give you that you want to take back into your career? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, or anywhere you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. If you want to gain insight from more women like me and our accomplished guests like Rasha, join us in one of our mastermind groups where we'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Check out some podcasts from one of our new sponsors. About a dozen great shows focused on lifestyle industries on Mouth Media Network, with top brand executives, industry leaders, and innovators in fashion, beauty, travel, real estate, content creation, and even spirituality industries and more. Check out Mouth Media Network, powered by Sennheiser, on iTunes, Google Play, and at mouthmedianetwork.com.